Chapter 33. After a grand processional of bishops and priests, a boys' choir, and Constantine's opening words, one of the first topics addressed at the council was the one brought forth by Arius, whether or not Jesus Christ was divine. Arius made his opening arguments, with great eloquence and great persuasion, in the presence of Constantine and the rest of the assembly. Jesus was, he asserted, perhaps the foremost of all created beings, but to be co-equal with God, one in substance and essence with him, was impossible, at least according to Arius. No one could be one with God, he said. Nicholas listened in silence, along with every other bishop in that immense room. Respect for the speaker, especially in the presence of the emperor, took precedence over any type of muttering or disturbance that might accompany other types of gatherings like this, especially on a subject of such intensity. But the longer Arius spoke, the harder it became for Nicholas to sit in silence. After all, Nicholas's parents had given their lives for the honor of serving Christ, their Lord. Nicholas himself had been overwhelmed by the presence of God in Bethlehem, at the very spot where God made his first appearance as man in the flesh. Dimitri, Samuel, and Ruthie had all been similarly affected by that visit to Bethlehem. They had walked up the hill in Jerusalem where the King of Kings had been put to death by religious leaders, leaders who, like Arius, doubted Jesus' claims to be one with God. Nicholas had always realized that Jesus was unlike any other man who had ever lived. After Jesus died, he had risen from the dead, appeared to the 12 disciples, and then appeared to more than 500 others who were living in Jerusalem at the time. What kind of man could do that? Was it just a mass hallucination? Was it just wishful thinking on the part of religious fanatics? But these weren't just fans, they were followers who were willing to give up their lives too for their Lord and Savior. The arguments continued to run through Nicholas's head. Hadn't the prophet Micah foretold, hundreds of years before Jesus was born, that the Messiah would be from old, from ancient times? Hadn't the apostle John said that Jesus was with God in the beginning, concluding that Jesus was God? Like others had tried to suggest, Arius said that Jesus had never claimed to be God. But Nicholas knew the scriptures well enough to know that Jesus had said, "I and the Father are one. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me?" Even Jesus' detractors at the time that he was living said that the reason they wanted to stone Jesus was because Jesus claimed to be God. The scriptures said that these detractors cornered Jesus one day, and Jesus said, "I have shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me?" They replied, "We are not stoning you for any of these, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God." Jesus had certainly claimed to be God, a claim that got him into hot water more than once. His claim showed that he was either a madman or a liar, or that he was telling the truth. Nicholas's mind flooded with scriptures like these, as well as with memories of the years he had spent in prison, years he would never get back again, all because he was unwilling to worship Diocletian as a god, but was fully willing to worship Jesus as God. How could Nicholas remain silent and let Arius go on like this? How could anyone else in the room take it, he thought. Nicholas had no idea. "There was nothing divine about him," Arius said with conviction. "He was just a man, just like any one of us." Without warning, and without another moment to think about what he was doing, Nicholas stood to his feet. Then his feet, as if they had a mind of their own, began to walk deliberately and intently across the massive hall towards Arius. Arius continued talking until Nicholas finally stood directly in front of him. Arius stopped. This breach of protocol was unprecedented. In the silence that followed, Nicholas turned his back towards Arius and pulled down the robes from his own back, revealing the hideous scars he had gotten while in prison. Nicholas said, "I didn't get these for just a man." Turning back towards Arius and facing him squarely, Nicholas saw the smug smile return to Arius's face. Arius said, "Well, it looks like you were mistaken." Then Arius started up his speech again, as if nothing at all had happened. That's when Nicholas did the unthinkable. With no other thought than to stop this man from speaking against his Lord and Savior, and in plain sight of the Emperor and everyone else in attendance, Nicholas clenched his fist. He pulled back his arm, and he punched Arius hard in the face. Arius stumbled back, both from the impact of the blow and from the shock that came with it. Nicholas, too, was stunned, along with everyone else in the room. With the same deliberate and intentional steps which he had taken to walk up to Arius, Nicholas now walked back to his chair and took his seat. A collective gasp echoed through the hall when Nicholas struck Arius, followed by an eruption of commotion when Nicholas sat back down in his seat. The disruption threatened to throw the entire proceedings into chaos. The vast majority of those in the room looked like they could have jumped to their feet and given Nicholas a standing ovation for this bold act, including, by the look on his face, even the Emperor himself. But to others, Arius chief among them, no words nor displays of emotion could express their outrage. Everyone knew what an awful offense Nicholas had just committed. It was, in fact, illegal for anyone to use violence of any kind in the presence of the Emperor. The punishment for such an act was to immediately cut off the hand of anyone who struck another person in the presence of the Emperor. Constantine knew the law, of course, but he also knew Nicholas. He had once even had a dream about Nicholas, in which Nicholas warned Constantine to grant a stay of execution to three men in Constantine's court, a warning which Constantine heeded and acted upon in real life. When Constantine shared that dream with one of his generals, the general recounted to Constantine what Nicholas had done for the three innocent men back in Myra, for the general was one of the three who had seen Nicholas's bravery in person. Although Nicholas's actions against Arius may have appeared rash, Constantine admired Nicholas's pluck. Known for his quick thinking and fast action, Constantine raised his hand and brought an instant silence to the room as he did so. "This is certainly a surprise to us all," he said, "and while the penalty for such an act in my presence is clear, I would prefer to defer this matter to the leaders of the council instead. These are your proceedings, and I will defer to your wisdom to conduct them as you see fit." Constantine had bought both time and goodwill among the various factions. The council on the whole seemed to agree with Nicholas's position, at least in spirit, even if they could not agree with his rash action. They would want to exact some form of punishment, since not to do so would fail to honor the rule of law. But having been given permission by the Emperor himself to do as they saw fit, rather than invoke the standard punishment, they felt the freedom to take another form of action. After a short deliberation, the leaders of the council agreed and determined that Nicholas should be defrocked immediately of his position as a bishop, banished from taking part in the rest of the proceedings in Nicaea, and held under house arrest within the palace complex. There he could await any further decision the council might see fit at the conclusion of their meetings that summer. It was a lenient sentence, in light of the offense. But for Nicholas, even before he heard what the punishment was going to be, he was already punishing himself more than anyone else ever could for what he had just done. Within less than a minute, he had gone from experiencing one of the highest mountaintops of his life to experiencing one of its deepest valleys. Here he was attending one of the greatest conclaves in the history of the world, and yet he had just done something he knew he could never take back. The ramifications of his actions would affect him for the rest of his life, he was sure of it, or at least for whatever remained of his life. The sensation he felt could only be understood, perhaps, by those who had experienced it before. The weight, the shame, and the agony of a moment of sin that could have crushed him, apart from knowing the forgiveness of Christ. When Nicholas was defrocked of his title as bishop, it was in front of the entire assembly. He was disrobed of his bishop's garments, then escorted from the room in shackles. But this kind of disgrace was a mere trifle compared to the humiliation he was experiencing on the inside. He was even too numb to cry.